We ask all the questions that others don't dare. We're dads on the air. We're back with Dads on the Air.
And welcome back to Dads on the Air, this 28th day of June 2011. And here we are in the middle of winter. A nice winter's day in Sydney today. And this is Bill Cable from Mediate Now. And with me in the studio is Ian Purdy from ianpurdy.com.
Yes, good morning, Bill. Good morning, listeners.
Well, we've got a very interesting show today. We've got our guests we'll be speaking to a little bit later include John Flanagan, who is the Deputy Registered Officer at the Non-Custodial Parents Party, Equal Parenting. And then we'll be speaking to Australia's leading social researcher and the author of 13 books, Hugh Mackay, well known to just about everyone in Australia. So it'll be great talking to Hugh about his most recent book. But before we get on to those guests, we might just go to some very important news developments this week. And the first one I might mention is the subject of a media release from Dads on the Air. It was submitted by Peter Vandervoord.
Rock and Pop.
Our own Rock and Pop. Peter has drawn attention to a comparison between what happened with those cows and what happens day in, day out with the children in this country. Peter's noted that on 30th of May 2011, the community, the media, the government were all outraged when confronted by the cruelty inflicted on Australian cattle in Indonesia, and it brought immediate government action. Quite extraordinary that the government could act so quickly in this respect, particularly when there's a certain amount of hypocrisy involved. The ritual killing of animals goes on in a number of abattoirs in Australia with full government approval, but nevertheless it was when on television in Indonesia that there seemed to be a good opportunity to take action against the Indonesians, I suppose, is the way it was seen. But unfortunately, it has a habit of coming back and biting you on your own backside, because within days, a whole industry was closed down in Australia and a valuable export trade was stopped in its tracks. Now, what Peter does is compare what happened there with the government, with what is reflected in the government-released ABS Family Characteristics Survey of 2009-2010, released only 3 days before the government acted on the cattle. So it was released on 27 May 2011, and it indicates the shameful statistics that since 1975, almost 24% of Australians have been denied meaningful contact with their biological families as a result of deep-rooted family law policy failure. Yet now, 1 month later, have not seen a word in the press, in the mainstream press, and not a sign of any community, media or government outrage from this appalling statistic. Instead, there's a deafening silence. And when we get this news of the crippling emotional cruelty being inflicted on Australian children and their powerless families, it would appear that the health and well-being of the nation's cows is much more important than the health and well-being of the nation's children and families. In the press release, Peter lists a summary of the findings from this report. There were 441,000 non-custodial parents. The vast majority, 81%, were fathers, and this has gone down a little bit. It was 82%. In 2006-2007, so there's been a 1% improvement, but nothing to write home about there. And using the benchmark definition of meaningful contact to represent a child spending 20% or more nights per year, that's pretty low, but even with that figure, spending that amount of time with their non-custodial parent, it reveals that that of the children who had little or no meaningful contact with their non-custodial parent, 45% of children never stayed overnight with their non-custodial parent, 24% rarely or never saw that parent, 19% of children spent less than 10% of nights with that parent, and so it goes on. It is absolutely an appalling statistic.
It is indeed. That's a childhood of torture, basically, being denied access to one of your parents, which you would think should be a fundamental right of every child, to have access to their parents.
Yes, so for more information, the media contact is Peter van der Voorde, and you can contact him on his email address is dotafeedback, dotafeedback at gmail.com. So we can only hope that we get a bit more effort taken with our children than perhaps the urgent and immediate action with the cows, which although as I said, didn't really result in a lot of benefit to Australia, as it turned out.
Yeah, well, and of course, there's also the case with the asylum seekers, with the father who has been accepted as a refugee in Australia, although he's still undergoing security checks and the like, and is still in detention. Meanwhile, his wife and son, three-year-old son, I believe, are about to be shipped off to Malaysia, and all they want to do is join the family together. And I find it unbelievable that the Australian government. You know, to me, it's a no-brainer. Surely this man's been accepted. He's been identified as a refugee. Surely his wife and son qualify in the same boat. Surely the family should be reunited as soon as is humanly possible. And all of this nonsense going through the media at the moment that he's eventually going to be released into Australian society while his wife and son are shipped out to Malaysia because of some technicality in the date of the legislation, that they just happened to arrive here a couple of days after the legislation was passed that sends everybody. I mean, it's a technicality and it's nonsense, and it's a disgrace that the Australian government should have so little regard for families and for the need for families to stay united, for mothers, fathers and children to be united and to be families, that they have such disregard for the very concept of family, that this no-brainer. They should have just got the family together, taken the wife and son out of Christmas Island and united them with the father. I mean, this is just basic humanitarianism. I don't know what's going on, why the government imagines that being so cold-hearted, you know, so cruel, is somehow going to endear them to the electorate, or who they think it's going to endear them to. I find the whole exercise to be absolutely disgusting, and it's a disgrace to all Australians that our elected representatives are prepared to allow this situation to go on and on and on.
Yes, it just seems to be pressure groups running wild, and I've heard the present government described as a train wreck, which...
You've heard, of course, the little boy from Christmas Island saying he just wants to see his father, he's desperate to see his father. I mean, they just fob that aside, like all of the kids who of divorced parents who don't get who want to see their father. They just ignore that. That doesn't mean anything to them. You know, let them have an uncle, you know, Marie Antoinette, let them eat cake, or, you know, let them have something else other than what they need. I mean, to me, it's ridiculous. It's heartless. And it just really goes to show that the government does not have families centre as a priority. They're not interested in families. They don't care.
Yes, there was a report that Morris Yemmer was going to be standing against the current Attorney General Robert McClellan in his seat. It was subsequently denied, but Robert McClellan has now distinguished himself further by releasing on the 27th of May an Institute of Criminology report together with the Minister for Justice, Brendan O'Connor. The Institute of Criminology report is titled Children's Exposure to Domestic Violence in Australia. And it makes it goes to state that children growing up in a violent household suffer risk as they grow older, which I think no one would disagree with. But it goes on to use this report to support the government's Family Law Legislation Amendment Family Violence and Other Measures Bill of 2011. McClellan says that the Family Violence Bill prioritises the safety of children, encourages people to bring forward evidence of family violence and child abuse, and helps families, professionals and the courts to better identify harmful behaviour through new definitions of family violence and child abuse, he said. Now, we'll be speaking to John Flanagan shortly about that bill, but I might just note that this report has also been a topic of some comment by others in the, including our own Greg Andreessen. Greg Andreessen notes that the that this paper, this current paper by the Australian Institute of Criminology, manages to ignore the largest ever Australian survey of young people and domestic violence. You'd wonder how this could happen. It was actually a survey conducted by the Attorney General's Department, published in 2001 by the National Crime Prevention Division of the Commonwealth Attorney General's Department and the Department of Education, Training and Youth Affairs. The national research involved a survey of 5,000 young Australians aged between 12 and 20 and in-depth discussions with special groups, namely homeless youth, victims of domestic violence and youth from different ethnic backgrounds. Now, you'd think that would be fairly useful resource to go back to.
Yeah, very relevant. On the money, you'd think that would be a major resource for them.
Mm. It's the largest sample of young people ever surveyed on their experiences of parental domestic violence in Australia, or most likely in the whole world. And the main findings relate to young people's understanding of and attitudes to domestic violence, their experiences of witnessing parental or carers' domestic violence, and of violence in their dating relationships, and how they deal with these experiences. Now, the key findings in that report, this is the largest ever Australian survey of young people and domestic violence, found that considering physical violence only, nearly a third of young people had witnessed one of the following: a male carer being violent towards his female partner, a female carer being violent to her male partner, or both carers being violent. 14.4% of young people reported that this violence was perpetrated both by the male against the female and the female against the male. 9% reported that violence was perpetrated against their mother by her male partner, but that she was not violent towards him. And 7.8% reported that violence was perpetrated against the father by his female partner, but that he was not violent towards her. Most reported parental violence seemed to be minor, in that no effects were reported by the majority of child witnesses. Where the young people had or were experiencing parental domestic violence, a third of them had not told anyone about it. And it's interesting that although males hitting females was seen by virtually all young people surveyed to be unacceptable, it appeared to be quite acceptable for a girl to hit a boy. Now, this is obviously not acceptable. We should be against all these all types of violence, but that same sort of logo seems to be, that same sort of thinking seems to have been grasped by our federal politicians, who never ever refer to female to male violence. And just finally, another, the best predictor of perpetration was witnessing certain types of female-to-male violence, while the best predictor of victimisation was having witnessed male-to-female violence. So there is the evidence is there, the studies are there, but the government chooses to either ignore them or cherry-pick them for reaching their end result. But we'll be speaking to John Flanagan in more depth about that a little bit later on.
Okay, well, I've got a couple of articles in this morning's Telegraph. One of them here, a hungry pregnancy can hurt your baby. The article says, pregnant women who eat for two could be lowering their baby's IQs by up to 5 points, research claims. They may also be putting them at risk of developing behavioural problems, eating disorders and mental health conditions such as schizophrenia if they gain excessive amounts of weight when pregnant. They don't define what excessive amounts of weight are. I think most women, when they're pregnant, think they eat for two. You know, you encourage them to eat more. They do tend to bulk up a little bit. A review of research done by scientists at McMaster University in Ontario, Canada, published in Obesity Review, claims hormonal and chemical changes could explain the disturbing results. They are disturbing. The fact that a mother eating could reduce a child's IQ or lead on to schizophrenia. That's a shocking. That's shocking, because that goes against all of the conventional wisdom, which says, you know, you're eating for two, eat more. This says no. Don't do that. You'll harm your baby. Oh well. Anyway, that's confusing. And here is another one. This is a bit more lighthearted. Father of all cheats. If you want to know if your husband will cheat, you may want to take a close look at your father-in-law. According to a new study, cheating really does run in the family, at least as far as men are concerned. The study, carried out by a team of Czech scientists, concluded that while men and women both had affairs, men were more likely to stray if their fathers had been unfaithful as they were growing up. Jan Havlicek told a conference of the human, European Human Behavior and Evolution Association that daughters were not affected in the same way by their mother's infidelity. Well, that's quite interesting, really. You'd wonder why girls didn't follow their mothers, whereas boys followed their fathers. That's very interesting. Yet another example of where male and female development is not parallel, that we are completely different. Actually, because there was another one, there was actually, let me see if I can find it here. They were some in Holland or somewhere, they were actually talking about treating all the children. Where are we? No, I'll have to come back with it. Ah, yeah, sex ban in Kindy. Stockholm. A preschool has stopped calling children him or her to stop them falling into gender stereotypes. The Igalia preschool in the Södermalm district of the Swedish capital has decided to engineer equality between the sexes from childhood. The option to implement the rules is underpinned by a theory that society gives boys an unfair edge. But child psychologist Jay Belsky questioned whether it was the right way to go, saying gender neutrality at its worst is emasculating maleness. Well, I'd agree with that. All of this nonsense, treating boys and girls as equals, is nonsense. There's no such thing as equality. It's a mathematical fiction. The idea that a man can equal a woman or a woman can equal a man is completely ridiculous. Viva la difference, I say, and we should not be trying to bring our children up as if they're all the same, because they're not. Because boys and girls learn differently, their brains are wired differently, they develop at different stages in different ways, and this is all just politically correct feminist nonsense as far as I can see, and should be thrown in the bin. So Sweden, you're going backwards. You're going backwards, people.
Now, just a couple of other stories that I'm sure we'll be hearing more about, but the with the child support, the a bill is presently before the government which would allow the child support registrar to delegate certain powers and functions to individuals outside the Department of Human Services and, in effect, outsource collection activities. The bill amends several criminal penalty provisions to ensure the offences in these provisions can be prosecuted successfully, and in particular, tougher obligations of an employer when they are required to hold money from an employee, and self-employed payers will also be further regulated. So we'll be hearing some more about that, but just to flag the that is a concern. And also to note that we're the old bugbear of AVOs. The people are starting to realise that the ease of obtaining an AVO is starting to clog up the courts. People get all sorts of frivolous, reasons for an AVO, and of course the serious part is when it, if it then finishes up in the family court, it is definitely a mark against you if you've got an AVO. So we need to be very vigilant and do not consent to AVOs as an easy way out. It's far better to go through the pain of fighting them.
Yep, absolutely.
So, look, we'll be back shortly with our first guest, and in the meantime, we'll have a short musical break.
Maybe I'm just too demanding. They grow so fast. You have to cherish every moment.
Please, Daddy.
You have a right to be involved in the life of your child. Dad's in Distress. 1-300-853-437.
We're back with Dad's on the Air.
And welcome back to Dad's on the Air, this 28th day of June 2011. And our guest this morning, who we welcome back to the show, is the Deputy Registered Officer of the Non-Custodial Parents Party Equal Parenting, John Flanagan. John, good morning.
Good morning. Thanks very much for having me back on the show.
Oh, it's a pleasure, John. And, John, you've recently submitted a submission to the Senate Inquiry on the Family Law Legislation Amendment, Family Violence and Other Measures Bill 2011. I wonder if you could perhaps just take us through, or let us know your concerns about it, and take us through what your arguments are on this.
Yeah, for sure. I've got some great concerns with the changes that are being proposed to the family law. It's apparent that this government is trying to promote the interests of a very narrow group of vindictive and misguided radical feminists, and they're doing this under the guise of the best interests of the child. I've had a cursory examination of the submissions of all the groups that have been made to the Committee of Inquiry, and there seems to be two common threads. One is that they want to redefine family violence from proven violence to alleged violence. Mm. And also what they're seeking to do is that this alleged violence against women is to be considered as violence against children. Mm. Now, I think that this is... Court is going to change the family law to a large extent, and also what it's going to do is it's going to be much harder for children to have contact with both parents after separation, because a mere allegation is very hard to refute.
Yes, well, the lesson doesn't seem to be learnt from the AVO situation, where you can make these allegations and it can then be treated as proven, and away you go. And yet we know that a lot of these allegations are false. Everyone seems to be admitting it.
Yeah, for sure. And what concerns me is also they're removing the financial penalties from the Family Law Act for people making false allegations, because the argument is that people will not make these allegations if they're going to be subject to financial penalties for making false allegations. Now, I believe that any genuine claim about violence will always be put. One doesn't consider the consequences. The consequences are for these people who lie and act deceitful.
Yes, it's extraordinary, isn't it, that there's a concern that that people should be allowed to make false allegations.
Well, I can see the result. The result will be an explosion of allegations. And we'll find that lawyers will promote this as a way of alienating the children from their former partner, from the former partner of the person who is in the dispute.
Yes, I mean, it's all just too easy, isn't it? You just say, I felt frightened, and I mean, that's a pretty easy thing to say, and that will be taken as the subjective evidence that that there is a violence, and therefore... The consequences flow, don't they?
Well, it's a pretty easy thing, is that what you do now is that when you're making an application, you make an application for interim orders, which is normally heard within 6 to 8 weeks. And then you, at the same time, you have to make a supplementary application for final orders, which is normally heard in 12 to 18 months' time. Mm. So with the interim orders, by making the false allegations, contact is suspended or it's stopped completely. And what happens is then the child doesn't see the other parent for a period of 12 months or 18 months. And when it comes to the final hearing, the court then says it's psychologically too distressful for the child then to be reunited with the other parent.
Yes.
And consequently, the other parent doesn't have contact with the child and vice versa.
Yeah,
it's all too easy.
Yes, and the damage is done. But
and the damage is done, yeah.
Even before you get to that interim stage, if the child's been living, say, with the mother... the judge is going to say, well, I'm not going to, at an interim stage, an interim stage, normally you don't hear any evidence. It's
that's
only all affidavits. So
that's correct.
The judge is not going to say, I'm going to make a major change, like, moving the child from, say, the one parent to another parent on the basis of affidavits.
That's right, because there's no witnesses brought into the interim proceedings. It's, as you just said, it's all based on affidavits. And under the current proposals, anything can be said, and there's no punishment for making false allegations.
Yes, it's quite extraordinary. Now, you mentioned that you think there's a feminist lobby that's pushing this. Who do you think is really pushing? I mean, because
I don't know. I'll be quite honest with you. I did a check. There's I did a count of the number of submissions, and there's 225, of which 125 are for the proposals. But when you check the 125 submissions, approximately half have been actually written by the same person. It's the same wording. Mm. So someone or some organisation is out there writing submissions to try and bump up the numbers so it looks as if there's a big push for these changes, but in reality it's coming from either one person or a very small group of people. Now, they're also at the same time they're applying political pressure on the government to make these changes.
Yes. So are all the submissions available?
Well, yes, they are available, but some are confidential, and therefore you cannot see what's in those submissions. So approximately there's about 40 confidential submissions.
Okay, so the bulk of them you can see?
The bulk of them you can see, yeah, approximately probably 80% you can see.
And where can you go to see those, John?
You have to go to the Australian Parliament House site, which is aph.gov.au,
right,
and then you go on to the committees, and then the Senate committee, and then you go down to what they call the Legal and Constitutional Affairs Committee, and you look into that part of the website.
Right. Now, John, this is all getting quite urgent because but I think at the moment you can still make submissions, is that correct?
Well, not really. The submissions closed about a month ago, but I have noticed that people are still making submissions. There was two or three submissions put in over the weekend.
Mm.
So I think you can, but I think that the problem is that there's a set agenda which is going to be hard to change.
Mm.
Because the person who wrote the final report is an ex-family court judge, and I can only say that he was selected for one reason, so that to give the desired result. Now, we're finding that there must be an agenda out there, because you wouldn't have this particular person writing the report unless you wanted the outcome that you desired.
Yes, and I think we know who you're referring to.
Yeah, for sure, yeah. But yeah. So this one particular ex-family court judge has put his opinions wide and far sort of thing about what he believes should happen. Unfortunately, it's not the mainstream opinion. We believe it's ultra-conservative type thinking, which should not be. It's not the normal way, but people think. Most people want to see their kids after separation, you know, and I think that's a normal reaction. They're not interested in different ideas and ideals. They just want to see their kids, and this is not going to happen with this new legislation. In actual fact, it's going to be a lot harder for both parents to be able to have contact with their children.
Now, what's the timing from here, John?
The timing is that there's a Senate inquiry at the end of next week, and they're due to report to the Senate in sometime in August, and they'll have a final vote in August in the Senate. But it's also very interesting is that the vote was originally supposed to be taken in the Senate in June, and the Senate is a hung Senate until the 31st of June this year, and then after the 1st of July, the Greens and the Labor Party will have a clear majority in the Senate. Now, what's happened is this inquiry has been postponed until after the Senate...
the reconstituted,
Until it's been reconstituted so that it has a clear majority of Green and Labor Party senators. So someone inside is actually pushing this agenda. It's not someone from outside. Mm. So it makes it very hard to overturn these sort of proposals.
Yeah, so it's going on past form. You'd expect both the Labor Party and the Greens to support this type of legislation.
It's almost certainly that they will. Now, it's already been passed. That's what intrigues me. It's already been fully passed by the House of Representatives. That was on the 30th of May this year, without question. So it went to the third reading speech, and it was passed on party lines. And now it's taken over a month now for it to go to a Senate inquiry, which was originally proposed to be early in June. Now, they've pushed this through, sort of thing, so they can make sure that the proposals will go through unchallenged. So I'm pretty confident they will. And therefore, what that means is that kids will see less of both parents after separation. Mm. And it's only to suit the agenda of a few select radical feminists.
Yeah, so after, assuming that you're correct, and there's every reason to believe you are correct, with the reconstituted upper house, it will then pass the Senate, and then does it go back to the House of Reps?
No, it's already gone through. As long as there's no changes recommended by the Senate, mm-hmm. It doesn't have to go back to the House of Representatives at all. They've passed it. They've passed the three reading speeches. So once it's passed by the Senate, it goes straight to the Governor-General for signature, and it becomes law.
Mm.
So it looks as though that's where it's headed to, and unfortunately it's going to hurt separated families a lot, particularly the kids.
Yeah, so at that stage all we can do is try and put some pressure on our local members and try and keep up the voice, because I think you would regard this as writing back the reforms of 2006.
Well, yeah, they're exactly right. The reforms were brought in. They weren't reforms that we would have liked, but at least they went part way there. But they're going to roll them back even further back before these changes were made in 2006. So they're really a retrograde step. Because the reforms in 2006, they just said the judge had to consider equal time shared parenting, whereas we wanted to bring in a mandatory rebuttal of equal time shared parenting.
Mm.
But now, with the family violence, see, the family violence now will go on top of the shared parenting issue. So it will be considered first in any application. It will be considered before shared parenting. So if there's any family violence or any allegations of family violence, and the judge accepts those as being legitimate reasons, and there's no reason why he shouldn't, it means we don't even get to the part where we have to consider should children have contact with both parents. We haven't got to that threshold, so because we've already been held up with the previous step of family violence.
Yes.
So it's been very well thought out, whoever's made the changes, to suit their agenda.
Yes, it's and I think you distinguish between the violence and the allegations of violence.
No one agrees with violence, but they should at least prove the violence. Now, there's three ways of trying to make the changes that they've proposed. Now, I believe what they should do is that they should make it mandatory for parents alleging violence against children to prove their allegations.
Mm.
And the second thing is that we should take away the adversarial approach out of the family court system.
Mm.
And the third thing is that we should have a rebuttal presumption of equal time shared parenting. They are the three solutions, but they're not on the agenda at the present time.
Yes, well, you know, there's got to be an argument for violence to be treated in its appropriate forum, which you'd have to think is the criminal court rather than the family court.
Precisely, yeah, for sure. Violence should be considered in the local court or whichever court is the appropriate court. Like in Victoria, it's the county court, or in New South Wales, it's the New South Wales local court. But it should be treated there. It shouldn't be contested in the family court. It's not the appropriate forum.
Yes, and we're speaking with John Flanagan, who's the Deputy Registered Officer of the Non-Custodial Parents Party Equal Parenting. John, when we talk about these allegations of violence, I think that we're assuming that these allegations are going to be made perhaps by the custodial parent who, we heard earlier the statistics at the moment, something like 81% are mothers when it's a sole parent. Is there anything to stop the males making these sorts of allegations against the females in this situation?
Yeah, for sure. But we've had just recently here in Wollongong, where I come from, in the district court, which is the appeal court to the local court, the local magistrate had a case before him where a male was making allegations of violence against his female or ex-female partner, and his words were, be a man, and he threw the case out of court. So it's we often find that there's two different attitudes taken, violence against women and violence against men.
So
very often the violence against men is not accepted.
But well, there are a number of hurdles, aren't there? You've got to get through the police, who might have that sort of attitude, and then you've got the magistrate and the whole community, until there's a greater awareness of what the real what was really going on in this area.
Well, the real problem also is the fact is that they're redefining family violence. Now we've got all types of family violence. We've got social, spiritual, economic, not just physical violence. And all you have to do is allege one of those types of violence, and to be reasonably apprehensive of that violence occurring for that particular form of violence to be accepted. Now that's very easy to make an allegation. It's very hard to disprove something when it's only an allegation. And unfortunately, under the current law, allegations have to be accepted.
So
just because you don't believe it's right, it doesn't matter. As long as someone alleges that, as long as they're reasonably apprehensive, the local magistrate has to accept that allegation as being true.
So an attempt at perhaps budgeting between the husband and the father and the mother might lead to an allegation of domestic violence.
Yeah, for sure. The fact is, withdrawal of, say, a credit card would be seen as economic violence. And then that then is translated as being violence against the child, which will be enough to reduce contact between the father and the mother. Sorry, say the father and the child. So it's a very much a scripted scenario. These present changes.
And you've got to think, I mean, apart from the damage this is going to do the family, what's going to be the effect on the workload of the courts?
Oh, for sure. Well, the thing about it is, it's going to make it much... it's going to increase the workload of the courts, because what's going to happen is that the lawyers will promote the alienation between the children and their former partner by encouraging these baseless claims as a tactic.
Well, we know that's already going on, don't we? And
For sure, but we'll find that it's going to be a lot more as a tool that will be used in the family court.
Because it's really all up for the party making the allegation, isn't it? I mean, there's no restriction on under these changes. There's no restraint on anybody making a false allegation.
Well, they're actually taking away that restraint. They're proposed to amend the legislation so there's no financial punishment for making a false allegation. So that's all part of this legislation.
And what is the current situation?
Is that if you make a false application, you can have a financial punishment by the courts. But that's now been taken away.
Yes, it's extraordinary that...
So basically all it does is it just encourages people who want to lie and act deceitful.
Yes. Because it's all up, isn't it? I mean,
it's all up. Yeah,
if you
it's property. Well, the thing about it is, there's property, there's child support, there's superannuation. All is up for grabs, and the more that you can use the process to your advantage, unfortunately, a lot of people will do it, and the lawyers will be behind it because they'll be advising their clients that this is the way to increase your property settlement or increase your superannuation payout or increase the child support that you will that you should be entitled to.
Yes. I mean, proposing that the court makes what they describe as a proactive inquiry into the single issue of family violence, the family court doesn't really have that facility, does it? I mean, they don't have a police investigation.
No, they're not geared for it. And also the fact is they don't have the how to put the time, and they don't have the evidence before them.
It's really going to be one person's word against the other, and then when it's a subjective test, well, there's really, I think you've pointed out, there's really no defence to it if someone says
it. Well, it's even worse than that, because what happens is that as long as one person has a reasonable apprehension that apprehension has to be accepted. It doesn't matter if it's true or not. Mm. It's just I've been in local court proceedings helping other people through these types of allegations in the local court, and I find that as soon as the mother says, "I have a reasonable apprehension of violence," the magistrate must accept that as fact, and he must make a decision in her favour.
So there's no testing as to why it's reasonable. There's no discretion. Mm.
So is that it's a very easy way to win a court case to go is to go into the court and say, "I have a reasonable apprehension of violence."
Yes, use the formula and words
and you've won.
Yes. Now, you were the non-custodial parents' party were invited to make a further submission in response. Was that is that a good sign? Is that
well, that's correct, because our submission must have upset this particular ex-family court judge who is behind these changes. Now, he actually did a response to our submission, and the Legal and Constitutional Affairs Committee allowed us time to make a response to his comments, and which we did, and we believe the comments are appropriate. Now, these comments are on the internet, so on the aph.gov.au site, and anyone can have a look at those comments. Now, we believe we've answered them correctly, and we believe that the person who made the allegations is looking at things from an ultra-conservative point of view, rather than from the normal point of view that most people would look at.
Yes, I'm sure that people in the community are not aware of the implications of this legislation. I think
that's right.
It's just, this will stop violence towards women and children. That's got to be a good thing. Let's give it a tick. That's about as deep as the thinking goes, I suspect.
Yeah, and that's not what it's about. You know, we certainly don't agree with any violence towards either party, whether it's male or female, but we don't believe that it should be used as a tool to gain access in a family court situation, and that's all it's being used as in this proposed legislation.
So, John, where do we go from here?
Well, there's nowhere to go to. That's the problem. Once it goes through the Senate and signed off by the Governor-General, it becomes law, and the judges then must follow that legislation in proceedings. So once it goes through that process, that's it. We've got no other option rather than to accept it, because that's the law.
Yeah, so in this particular area, we will have to accept it. We'll have to hope that the judges show a bit of common sense. Or that.
Oh, well, unfortunately, you're saying something that's probably not going to happen.
No, it's a bit of an oxymoron in the family law area, I suspect.
Yeah. Look, it's a real problem, and well, we're finding I saw some figures the other day that people, inmates in local prisons, 80% of them come from single parents.
Mm.
And that's the sort of problems that we're going to end up with. Yeah, we're going to end up with all these sorts of social issues as a result of this legislation. Now, the Senate and the House of Representatives have not considered the consequences of this legislation.
No, and they're long-term effects, which, you know, in parliaments last for 3 years. They're they're not very good at looking at long-term effects of things.
Well, it's the same as the court process. As soon as the judge makes his decision, he no longer thinks about the consequences of that decision.
No, absolutely.
Some of these decisions should be reviewed after several years so that the actual consequences of the judge making the decision should be looked at.
Yeah, an excellent idea. Unlikely, I suspect.
Oh, very unlikely, for sure, very unlikely, but it's what should happen.
Yes, I mean, we need to greatly expand the court's resources to do that.
That's right, yes. Oh, look, it's extremely unlikely to happen, but it's just wishful thinking, but it would be nice if it did happen.
It's sensible thinking. Well, yeah. We've got to hope that the sensible thinking starts to prevail. John Flanagan from the Non-Custodial Parents Party. John, if people want to follow what you're doing, what the party's doing, is there a website they should go to?
For sure. We have our website. It's www.equalparenting.org.au.
Great. www.equalparenting.org.au.
That's correct.
And you can follow the party.
And you can see our submissions. We've made various submissions. This process just hasn't happened overnight. It's It's happened over a couple of years, and we've made submissions to every inquiry over the last couple of years, and it still hasn't changed the progress of this current legislation.
Yes, and I could commend the quality of those submissions. They're always excellent
and thanks very much.
Good reading. So, John, thank you very much for coming on the program, and we wish you all the best.
Okay, thanks very much for having us. Okay,
thanks,
thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Ever there anyway.
Dad's in distress, meeting your area every week. If you're a non-custodian parent and would like to know who to contact or just want someone to talk to, help is just a phone call away. Dads in Distress, 1-300-853-437 or dadsindistress.asn.au.
We're back with Dads on the Air. Welcome back to Dads on the Air this 28th day of June 2011. And our next guest is Hugh McKay. Hugh is a psychologist, a social researcher and novelist. He has 50 years of experience of social research, and over that period he's been the author of 13 books, including a number of bestsellers. And we're going to speak today about his latest book called What Makes Us Tick, The 10 Desires That Drive Us, which came out last year. Hugh, good morning.
Good morning, Bill.
It's great to have you on the show, and I must say, I've read a number of your books, and I think the this What Makes Us Tick is probably a distillation of even some of your novels, but also the social research. Is that the way you see it? Did it come to you as a...
I think that's a very good way of describing it, Bill. I felt as though I'd reached the stage in my career where it was time to step back a bit from the sort of day-to-day research that I've been doing for all these years, tracking how people are reacting to changes in our society, technology, the economy, etc., etc., and really look a bit more deeply at what drives us regardless of the circumstances we happen to be in. So, yeah, it's really drawing on all of that research and as you say, the reflections that are not necessarily strictly based on research, but just reflections. And of course, I've drawn on lots of other people's research and wisdom of the ancient philosophers and so on. So it's very much an attempt to take a fresh look at this. I mean, it's a pretty well-worn subject, why we do the things we do, this whole field of human motivation. But I thought it was time to take a fresh look based on my experience of listening to people talking about their lives through all these decades of research.
Yes, and I think it's perhaps more personal than the social research that you do, looking at various groups. You've actually narrowed it down to something that I think we all want to know. What is it that makes us tick? Why do we do the things we do? And why are there so many conflicts between what perhaps we think we'd be doing and what we actually do?
Yes. Yes, that's right. Conflict, I think, is the right word. Because really all of us are driven by a number of different desires. I think we're often puzzled by our own behavior or even by other people's behavior. Mm. Because we forget two things about human nature. One is that we're not fundamentally rational creatures. We like to say we're rational creatures, but if we keep persisting with this idea that we're rational, we're always going to be amazed and disappointed because so much of what we do is not rational, and you know we're ruled much more by the heart than by the head. Brain researchers say, you know, the brain is much more like a gland awash with hormones than a computer. And of course we're capable, with very careful education and training and discipline, we're capable of behaving quite rationally, but that's not our nature. And so we need to be a bit more understanding, a bit more sympathetic about the fact that, you know, the car keys are not likely to be where you thought you left them. but the other reason why I think we're so often puzzled by our behavior, which is really the point of this book, is that everything we do is the product of an interplay of a number of different motivations. It's not as if we do things for just one reason. You know, it's not just one factor driving us to live here or marry that person or have children or do that job or go to this movie or whatever it might be. Everything we do is the result of a very dynamic, continuous interaction, interplay, or as you said, really a contest between these various desires that are driving us, and it's never just, I mean, the explanation is never simple.
No, because You've listed 10, but I see you also believe that more than one of those desires or drives could be affecting us at any particular time.
Yeah, exactly. I think it makes sense to assume that there'll be 3 or 4 or 6 or 7 desires operating at any given moment. I mean, if you think about a person at work, for example, who's working very long hours, maybe being accused by others of being a workaholic, and perhaps doesn't need the money or could have retired or something, they keep on working and it seems irrational, and then you look at why are they doing that, and you realize that there's probably, I mean, the desire to be taken seriously is often bound up with work, where we often feel we're taken more seriously than in other places. The desire to be useful is very powerfully satisfied by work. The desire to belong to a little work group or to an organizational tribe, this is a powerful desire that is satisfied by work. Even the desire for control, to have some control over what's happening, which is often not satisfied in our personal lives but is often satisfied at work. And also another one of these basic desires, the desire for my place, for having a little spot somewhere on the planet that feels like mine, that feels like a place where I'm in control and comfortable and that somehow symbolizes me or defines me in some way. We have lots of those places in our lives, but for many people, the workplace is like that. It becomes a place they become emotionally very attached to. So, there I think I've mentioned just in those moments 6 or 7 different desires which could all be being satisfied by a person's decision to work very long hours or to stay at work longer than they need to, even though, on the face of it, that might seem irrational. It makes perfect sense when you realize how many desires are being satisfied. And another good example, Bill, of that sort of interplay would be religion, which is regarded by many people as a very irrational aspect of human behavior, human nature, and yet through the centuries, millions of people have drawn comfort, have helped to make sense of their lives, etc., from religious faith and practice. And the question of whether it's rational or irrational doesn't really come into it, because so many of their desires are being satisfied all at once by their religious experience. So, again, it's the interplay between them and not just one factor.
Yes, whether it's right or wrong or rational or irrational, there are certain desires which you point to why we're following this path, or a lot of people are anyway.
That's right. And of course, we're mostly not terribly conscious of these desires. We become conscious of them when they're frustrated. For example, the one that I think is in many ways, for most people, the most fundamental of the 10 is the desire to be taken seriously. Well, if you're being taken seriously, if in your working life and your personal life people are acknowledging you and appreciating you and noticing you, and that's the sense in which I refer to being taken seriously, well, then you're not really conscious of that desire needing to be met. But if your partner is no longer listening carefully to you, well, you probably read that as, well, she doesn't take me seriously anymore, and that becomes a really powerful factor in your life. Or, if at work you're not properly acknowledged, and feel as though you're not being taken seriously, or if you belong to a minority group that isn't being taken seriously, then that desire to be taken seriously can become paramount, can become a really potent force because it's being frustrated. And that's true for the other desires as well. I mean, the desire for my place that I referred to in the context of work, that's a desire that's very powerful for all of us. We all need sacred sites or, places of one kind or another that say things about us that we're pleased to have said. And mostly we're not conscious of that need unless it's frustrated, and you can see that most graphically in the case of migrants who move from a birth country where they've got all these places that are important to them and precious and perhaps symbolize important stages of their lives or moments of emotional crisis or whatever it might be, and then they move to a new country where no such places exist. And it takes a very long time to establish that connection with place. And so you often do hear migrants, particularly those who've moved in their middle years to a new country, describing this problem that's often described as rootlessness, where they feel as though they don't quite belong anywhere. And that mightn't be, you know, they might have made good friends in their new country and so on. They might have family around them. They might have a good job. Lots of other desires might be being satisfied, but that desire for my place might be frustrated. And then that becomes a source of great sadness for many people in the migrant population.
Yes, and talking of sadness, I'm interested in the chapter Desire for Control, when you refer to take the Australian case. You say, in the past 35 years, Australians have reinvented the institution of marriage and abandoned it in droves, thereby transforming the nature of family life. Almost 25% of Australian families with dependent children are now single-parent families. This has sent the birth rate tumbling to an all-time low, shrunk our households, and had these enormous effects. Now, I can see that the family situation would come under that desire for control. It might also be desire for my place. It might be desire to connect. It might be desire for love. There are quite a few factors that might come into that.
Yes, very much so, Bill. And apart, even apart from the ones you've mentioned, the desire to belong also. Most of us do have a powerful need to belong in two ways, to belong to small herds, and human herds are typically, you know, 5 to 8 people, which used to be the size of a typical Australian household, but now the typical Australian household is 2 or 3 people. Mm. That's a bit suboptimal for a herd. But so we need other ways of finding herds to belong to, whether they're at work or, you know, at clubs or associations we might belong to, or book clubs or choirs or all sorts of herds, but also tribes. We need to be connected to traditionally the extended family, but so many extended families are dislocated or fragmented. So we need other, you know, perhaps religious tribes or sporting tribes or political tribes. But when it's functioning well, the family really, as you say, does satisfy most of the desires on the list. The desire to be taken seriously, the desire for my place is often associated with home, not necessarily home itself, but perhaps bed or a favourite armchair or a den or somewhere. The desire to connect, the desire to belong, the desire for love, even the desire for control to some extent, feeling as though this is somewhere where I can be myself and have things reasonably under control.
Yes, well, I think the dark side of that is perhaps after a separation or divorce, and one parent wants to have the control over the children, because that seems to be the only explanation I can see for some behaviour that goes on, you know, limiting the access to the other parent of the child, and making it difficult, and, you know, making all the decisions. All these things, I think, would come under that control desire.
That's very true. When we feel as though we've lost control, that almost always brings out the worst in us. And you mentioned some of the huge social and cultural, economic and other upheavals in Australian society at large that have left many people over the last 25 or 30 years feeling as though things are out of control in general. And many people find that very troubling. Their anxiety levels go up. I mean, most of our classic phobias, like fear of flying or fear of travelling in lifts or fear of open spaces, all those things, they're all associated with the fear of loss of control. So, you know, people might resort to tranquilizers or antidepressants or alcohol or, you know, various things to try and soften or dull this rather anxious state of feeling out of control. But in the family situation, particularly the broken family situation, as you've described, the separation and divorce, one of the things that many people feel about that, particularly a partner who's left behind. I mean, the partner who leaves often feels as though she or he has taken control. You know, now I'm going to get my life under control, going to do things my way. I'm out of an unhappy relationship where I feel as though I perhaps was not taken seriously, where my voice was not heard. But the one who's left often feels as though the world has collapsed, loss of control, and so then you do see ugly behavior, which if children are present, but even if children are not present, you see this sort of thing, ways of sort of overcompensating for the collapse of your world and the loss of control. So you do get cases where people become obsessive about control, you know, as you say, with access visits. You know, you were supposed to be here at 2 o'clock,
yes,
and it's 2:05, you know,
yes,
as though this is the end of the world. People can become very neurotic, almost out of control with anxiety as a result of feeling that they've lost control, and then becoming, even perhaps uncharacteristically, becoming control freaks in the short term, about things like access or property settlements and so on.
And this can be made worse by, I think also as part of this control, is perhaps a tendency to denigrate the other person's bad behaviour. If you can say, well, that's because he or she is this or that, it perhaps gives another feeling of control, which only exacerbates the situation.
Yes, absolutely right. When we feel we're superior and we're in a position of being able to criticise and denigrate other people, that does in the short term give us a sense of being in control of the situation, but of course it's very hollow. And this is one of the tragedies, of course, about human nature, and there are many, many dark aspects of human nature, but loving relationships that turn bad often turn very bad. So the desire for love can become very perverted, distorted, when a relationship breaks down. So, you know, even though people might say, well, you know, I don't love him anymore, but I'm certainly not going to let anyone else have him, or, you know, this sort of stuff. It's quite ugly and completely irrational, but very human when we feel this sense of, you know, things of slipped out of our control, even being loved.
Yes, I guess I'm focusing on the control chapter because perhaps I found that the most interesting one for me. But it also is very interesting in international relations, as I think you make the comment that things like weapons of mass destruction and some of the motives that are given for going into war are probably to do with a lack of feeling and control, like the war against terrorism, for instance, another one where we...
Yes. Oh, that's right. That's right. The war is a fascinating and very dark, of course, appalling example of how these desires can run away with us. You know, we can... you know, the desire for control combined with the desire for more, whether it's more territory or more adherence to our faith or, you know, whatever it is, more patriotism, more wealth, more oil, put that together with the desire for control. And a megalomaniac, of course, it's control of the world, the Adolf Hitler syndrome, or the Napoleon complex, these sort of things. But even if it's not that, yes, it does bring out very ugly behavior. And of course, on a smaller scale, it also brings out a very strange form of behavior that you can see in contemporary Australian society, which is people feeling as though they feel as though their lives should be under control, and if their lives are under control, then they'd be happy.
Yes.
And so we've got this mad sort of pursuit of happiness, as though that's a sign that we've got, you know, that our kids are behaving well and we're materially prosperous and things are under control, therefore we're happy. And of course, most of the time we're not happy. We're not that we're sad, but we're just other things. You know, there's a very wide spectrum of human emotions, all of which are completely authentic. And I think we're in a rather tricky situation in our culture at the moment where we're feeling as if it's too important to be happy, and that's just another symptom of our desire for control.
Yes, we're speaking with Hugh McKay, the author of What Makes Us Tick, The 10 Desires That Drive Us, and just again in this area, but you've referred to the mad pursuit of perfection. And again, in the family law area, it seems that for dads, they have to be the perfect dad, or it's going to be a tick against them. And really, it's
another
not
manifestation, Bill, as you say, of the desire for control. You know, if we've got things under control, everything will be perfect. We'll have the perfect kitchen. We'll go on perfect holidays. We'll find the shop where we get the perfect latte. We'll have perfect kids with perfect marks, and they'll be taught by perfect teachers in perfect schools. You know, we know this is not possible. But we do. There is this cult of perfectionism at the moment, which I think is very unhealthy for us. You know, when I hear about the counter-revolution of people writing books like The Good Enough Parent, I cheer, because I think that's what we need. We need to get back to a more realistic understanding of what's possible for us, and perfection is not possible for us. No dad is the perfect dad. Most dads do their very best, and most dads, like most mums, in some way fail and in some way damage their kids and, you know, make fools of themselves and disappoint themselves and disappoint their spouses and so on. That's just part of how it is, and we keep trying. But if our goal, if our standard is some sort of perfection, then we're going to live with frustration and disappointment all the time.
Yes, well, one of the things that you suggest is a way of perhaps dealing with this desire is, in its darker aspects, would be to lower our expectations of how we should feel and what we can have and what we can control.
And, yes, absolutely. I think a real breakthrough for most of us, and it sometimes takes most of a lifetime to get there, unfortunately, but a breakthrough for most of us is when we understand how much really is beyond our control. And that, in particular, our kids. You know, it's not our job as parents to control kids. It's our job to love them and support them and discipline them when necessary and offer them guidance and try to inspire them and all of those wonderful things. But control is the wrong word. Same as it's the wrong word for teachers to think they've got to control their students. They've got to inspire them and educate them and all of that sort of stuff. But control is a dangerous word because it suggests that other people will do what we want them to do, that we'll sort of control them like a puppet master. The only life we can control is our own life. And it takes us a long time, I think, to wake up to that. We don't even have the right to try to control other people's lives, including partners and kids, let alone employees or students. So that I think, is an important breakthrough. It doesn't mean we're abdicating responsibility. It just means our focus, our perspective, is a bit different.
Yes, it's look, I think that is just so important. If we could get over this idea of controlling children, particularly after a separation, there's this strong desire to, you know, you can't trust the other parent. I want to control what the child does.
Yes.
And that just leads to, I mean, certainly not good for the child either. It's not good for anyone.
No, that's right. It lays a very heavy burden on the child. And, you know, finally, we do have to realise, it's very hard, of course, to realise it in a situation where things are emotionally fraught with a fresh separation or, you know, an unpleasant divorce. But we finally do have to realise that it is our job as parents to encourage our children towards independence as soon as possible, for them to understand that they are their own people, you know, that they have to make choices and decisions and face the consequences of those. And of course, they need a lot of guidance for a very long time, but they are not part of us. You know, they are separate from us, and it's not our responsibility. It's not even our right to control them.
Yes, I must say, just looking at the book as a whole, I found it, of course, fascinating and much much more interesting and helpful to me than what you might describe as self-help books. But what do you see as the way of improving things? Is your book meant to help us understand, and therefore we can take action to improve, or how do you see the way forward?
Yes, very much so. I certainly wouldn't characterize it as a self-help book. I mean, there are just one or two points in the book where I do actually give a bit of advice very tentatively, for example, about the need for creative outlets in our lives, a creative self-expression. We need to take photographs or draw or paint or sing or dance or write or do something that is a creative outlet. That's very healthy for us in lots of ways. And so there are just moments like that in the book. But no, broadly, it is exactly as you've said, Bill. My hope is that reading this book, we will understand ourselves a bit better and be a bit more conscious, particularly of when our desires are being frustrated and therefore we're at risk of behaving badly because of those frustrations, but also to understand the same thing in other people, that they also are struggling with the contest between these various desires. They're also trying to deal with the emotional problem of one or more of these desires being frustrated. So I hope we'd be a little kinder on ourselves, but a lot kinder on others, in recognizing how this, what I've described in the book as the dynamic interplay between these desires, does produce what might otherwise seem as quite irrational behavior.
Yes, well, I know one of your desires is to keep on writing, and it's certainly the same. A lot of the people in the community have the same desire that you will keep on writing.
That's very nice. Thank you.
I'd just like to put in a little plug and hope that one of these days you might be able to turn your attention to the plight of the poor old dads who don't get to see their children. They get all their assets taken in a property settlement. Then they have child support to deal with, and I think this affects such a huge part of our population in Australia. It'd be wonderful if we could get you to do some investigation. But that's my little plug for today.
Yeah, well, I take that on board. I mean, I've been through the problem of separation and divorce and custody and access issues and property settlements, those sort of things. I know about all that pain, and yes, it's a painful subject even to talk about when you've been through it. But certainly it's a huge, often hidden social issue, a cause of a great deal of angst in our community and anxiety and depression and anger, which of course also can bring out the worst in us, and we can feel not just bewildered by our own behaviour but even a bit ashamed of it.
Well, it's been an absolute pleasure talking to you, Hugh. We're speaking with Hugh McKay, Australia's leading social researcher and the author of a book, What Makes Us Tick, The 10 Desires That Drive Us. Hugh, if people, they can get that book at the local bookstore, I guess?
Yes, virtually any bookstore either has it in stock at the moment or can very easily get it. It's still very much in print. In fact, there's just been a new printing completed, so it should be very readily available. Thank you, Bill.
Okay, and I think there's a website here. Is it www.humakay.com.au/books? Is that should they go to that
site?
That's
right. Yes, that lists all my previous books. Yes,
that's great. Yes, there's a number of books, and I'm looking at the list of achievements and recognition. It's fantastic effort you've made. So, Hugh McKay, we're very grateful for you coming on the program today. I'm sure we could talk for hours, but thank you for making the time available, and we wish you all the best with that book.
Well, thank you very much, Bill. It's been a pleasure to talk to you also.
Thank you.
Wasted kisses, red turns to blue. My kisses were wasted on you. Wasted hours and wasted pursuit. I was wasting my time picking the wrong fruit. The storm clouds opened. Down came the rain.
just went down the drain. Wasted promises, wasted lies, wasted kisses, wasted goodbyes. Wasted kisses, red turns to blue. My kisses were wasted on you. Wasted hours and wasted pursuit. I was wasting my time picking the wrong fruit. Here today, gone tomorrow. The only thing that's left of value. Wasted, baby, wasted. Wasted all my time and all my kisses on you. Wasted, baby, wasted. Wasting all my time and all my kisses on you. Yeah, we were wasted, baby, wasted. Wasting all my time and all my kisses on you. Yeah, we were wasted, baby, wasted. Wasting all my time and all my kisses on you.
Meeting your area every week. If you're a non-custodian parent and would like to know who to contact or just want someone to talk to, help is just a phone call away. Dads in Distress, 1300 853 437 or dadsindistress.asn.au.
We're back with Dads on the Air. Welcome back to Dads on the Air. This is the last time for this Tuesday, 28th of June. We're just about out of time. We'd like to particularly thank our guests today, John Flanagan, who is the Deputy Registered Officer of the Non-Custodial Parents Party, Equal Parenting, who spoke to us about the pending family law legislation amendments, which causes all some concern. And we also spoke to Hugh McKay, who's Australia's leading social researcher and the author of 13 books, including most recently What Makes Us Tick, which is something we all want to know, I think, the 10 desires that drive us. So it was great to speak to Hugh and John today, and we'll be back next week with another show. I think I can hear the music starting. So
that's it. It's just about the end of our time here. Yeah, so, hand it on to Country Bob in the saddle. He'll be on with Country On in about 4 minutes' time.
Yes.
So stay tuned to 89.3 to GLF.
So stay tuned there. And so it's Bill Cable from Meg Etnow and Ian Purdy
saying goodbye. Have a good week. Look after each other. Be nice to each other.
And if you want to listen to the show again, you can go to our website, www.dadsontheair.net, where you can listen to this show again or any of our past shows. And there's a whole lot of other good material on the website. So until next week, it's goodbye from Dads on the Air.
We're Dads on the Air. We're here because we care. We ask all the questions that others don't dare. We're Dads on the Air. We're Dads.